I'll ask you about this.
Blog Talk Radio.
All right, folks, this is Rabble. Let's do it again. All right, folks, this is Rabble Rouse and Rich Bergeron.
Yo, this is Tornado Tiny Pennycow.
We have DeMarcus Chop Chop Corley going to join us in the 9:15 hour. We have plenty of other boxing and mixed martial arts to talk about, of course. The 158 event. And an interesting editorial I read this week about mostly boxing-related interviews after the fight. I guess you could apply... Now, I guess this could be one of our TNT matchups. If you guys argue whether they should get rid of the after the fight interview because of stuff like Timothy Bradley the other night after his fight, and he won, and he was like, "Yeah, I had a concussion."
Yeah.
Referee asked him, "You know, what did you just say to me?" And he didn't even remember. He said 2 seconds ago. So there was somebody that wrote an article about, you know, should we get rid of post-fight interviews? Should we let these guys rest?
I don't think so. I know when Tom gets on, I mean, maybe we can, you know, just get a, you know, his opinion on it also. I think if the post-fight interview is done correctly, no, it should not be, you know, abolished. It's interesting to see, you know, or hear a photo right after you come out, you know, of a battle, you know, of a fight, of sometimes a life and death struggle. Sometimes it's interesting to see a guy or hear a guy after he's been in a fight where he was, you know, he's been unjustly, you know, cheated out of a win. You know, you have a lot of fights that are very close. Also, when we get Tom on the air, I want to, you know, I want to talk to him about the Bradley Provodnikov fight from last week. Just because I want to throw some things, you know, at him, you know, and pick his brain a little bit also. But with the post-fight interviews, I mean, I've seen them go absolutely fantastic. I've seen them go absolutely terrible, and I can give a couple examples of each. The one that always sticks out in my mind of a great post-fight interview was Dr. Douglas after he beat Mike Tyson. And then this one, this is, you know, Buster, how do you do this? And I remember him, you know, he was saying, my mother. And then they said he wanted for his mother. And then he came out and started crying because I wanted for my mother, God rest her soul. And that was great because she passed away only 3 weeks prior to the fight. That was, you know, a post-fight interview. Obviously, 23 years later, I still remember. Then there were other ones that I thought were absolutely terrible. And some examples I can bring up, two Larry Merchants and a Jim Gray. Larry Merchant, when Bernard Hopkins fought a guy by the name of Murad Hakkar back in 2003, I was at the fight.
Okay, we're back.
All right.
We had a little messed up connection there. Sure. What happened? It was right when I tried to connect Tom, not to throw anybody under the bus. But just conked out on me. I don't know if it has anything to do with the snow or what's going on. Maybe too many people are online checking their basketball scores.
Could be.
Anyway, you were in the middle of something about Larry Merchant.
I was talking about good post-fight interviews and bad post-fight interviews because we were talking about the after last week, should they eliminate post-fight interviews? And I said, well, it all depends on, how they're done. And a lot of it depends on the interviewer. I said, one that I'll always remember is a good one was when Buster Douglas beat Mike Tyson. And, he was almost sobbing, in dedication to his mother, who had just passed away about 3 or 4 weeks prior to the fight. But then a couple of the ones that I remember as bad ones were almost became hostile between the interviewer and the interviewee. Larry Merchant, when Bernard Hopkins fought Murad Haqqar in Philadelphia, and Haqqar was, he was a non-deserving number one contender. The guy got in the ring, he ran. Hopkins could have taken him out in 2 rounds, but he prolonged it to 8. And Merchant got in there and started yelling at Hopkins, with regards to the fight, saying this guy was a joke and this guy was that. And Bernard was like, well, he's the number one contender. I don't want him taking my belts away. I had to fight him, and Larry was in his case. And I'll never forget the end of it. Larry's like, well, and Bernard's like, well, I got paid today, didn't I? And Larry's like, you got paid for doing a whole lot of nothing. And Bernard's like, well, you get paid for doing a whole lot of nothing every night. another infamous bad Larry Merchant one was just about a year and a half ago, the Floyd Mayweather Victor Ortiz fight, when everybody knew that, okay, did Mayweather have to beat Ortiz the way he did? No. He was beating him, without the punch after the hugs and the kisses and all that when Ortiz headbutted him. And why Victor Ortiz is on Dancing with the Stars right now, I don't know, but I'm not going to get into that. That's when Mercer came out with the famous, if I was 50 years younger, I'd kick your ass. No, you wouldn't, Larry. If you were 50 years younger, if you were, 80 years younger, if Floyd was 80 years old and you were 30 years old, he'd still kick your ass. But one of the worst interviewers that I could never sit and still can't stand is Jim Gray on Showtime. And I remember one time he went and interviewed Mike Tyson, and this was recently after Jim Gray was very rude to Pete Rose on the air, and Mike looked at him and said, I won't interview until you apologize to Pete Rose on the air right now. And he humbled Jim Gray and made him do it, which I thought was great. But one interview with Jim Gray that sticks out in my mind, and he always had a reputation of being rude, was Samuel Peters and Jeremy Williams. Now, this was a fight that I knew Williams was not going to win. Williams was a tremendous athlete as a boxer, but he had a terrible chin. He had a terrible chin, and sometimes, if they were in a clinch, he would wobble, without even getting hit. I liked him as a fighter, but the fact of the matter is he had a glass chin. And I knew Peters, being 250 pounds, as soon as he hit Williams, it was going to be over. Second round, he catches him with a big sweeping left hook.
It's a highlight reel.
Flattens Williams out cold. Now, they interviewed Peters, and I don't even remember what he said. But now, Jeremy Williams is sitting on a stool. The guy's still obviously out of it. And Jim Gray is making him watch the replay of the knockout. And he's like, how do you feel about this? And Jeremy's like, wow, that doesn't look good now, does it? You don't want to make a guy watch the replay of his own knockout, especially one that was a highlight real knockout. I thought it was totally classless.
I always
liked doing post-fight interviews. I'll tell you two of my favorites. Sean O'Grady when he was with USA and Al Bernstein on ESPN. Because they were always so smooth. They never let emotions take over. And that's hard sometimes, especially when you're a guy like O'Grady that was a former world champion. You're in there and you're watching the fight, and maybe a guy's showboating or, belittling his opponent, or he won a fight that he shouldn't have won. And your competitive juices stir up, But he was always smooth, and that's why I always liked him. But since we got Tom on the air, Tom, I don't know if you heard the beginning of the debate, but they were talking about after last week the possibility of abolishing post-fight interviews, and I'd like to get your take on that.
Well, first off, I don't think it's going to happen. I can't imagine it happening, but...
It was quite editorial. I think it was just to make a point.
Yeah,
guys
but...
So banged up. Maybe you should talk to them right after their fights because they say some crazy
things. Well, I guess my question on Larry Merchant, what was Larry Merchant's pro boxing record? Does anyone remember? Okay, now I'm getting silence here from the experts. I'm getting silence, okay? Yeah, and I think Jim Gray just was, I agree with your analysis on them, but I think done correctly. Now, I don't know about talking to the guy who's just been beat up. I mean, depending on the condition he's in, that's wrong. But I do think that if it's a close decision, I'd like to hear from both parties.
Right.
I'd like to hear, you know, if it's close and controversial, let these guys talk, by all means. But, no, I don't like the idea of getting rid of it. But, again, Al Bernstein and Sean O'Grady, yeah, they knew how to do it. So.
Well, what did you think of Diaz's rant this last Saturday, Tom?
Oh, where do we? And of course, you're asking me now as a tax man. I'm thinking, how many? You know, I didn't think he took that many headshots. And this is a wonderful time when there's a couple million people listening in on this to say, "Oh, I've never paid a penny in taxes in my life." And I'm thinking, Nick, what are you doing? Oh, you need me? I'll email him. Come on, you need my services. I keep people out of jail for this, or try to. Don't always succeed. But, oh my God.
His trainer has come out in his defense recently, and he's managed him. So I was thinking, you know, one of his managers must have been paying his taxes. And according to his manager, he's actually overpaid his taxes. It's something about filing that he's worried about. It was a couple of years ago he had a tax issue, and he's fixated on that. But he's paid his taxes. It's just about filing, according to his manager.
I don't know how you pay if you don't file, unless he'd been sending in estimates. But I mean, I can't conceive of that scenario. I mean, there's got to be more to the story, and hopefully, it's just Diaz just being Diaz.
I think that the world of boxing, the world of mixed martial arts, needs more influence in the world of professional wrestling, because right now, I know exactly who they need. They need a wrestler. He was a former Syracuse All-American by the name of Mike Rotundo, who was better known as the name of Irwin R. Shikester, IRS. Make sure that the wrestlers paid their taxes.
Yeah.
Well, you hear the name of Diaz's lawyer. His name is Jonathan Tweedale.
Okay.
He says, Nick thought Caesar was taking care of taxes for him, and Caesar wasn't. Doesn't mean Nick is screwed, but it does mean things need to be figured out.
Yeah, like yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just coincidentally, Nick was actually stopped in California. I think the night after his fight, and found somebody in the car with concentrated cannabis on them. It wasn't his, though. And he got a complete walk, but he tweeted pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, California, I understand, even if you don't have a license, it's still a misdemeanor if it's a small amount. So, mm-hmm. Oh, boy, what a bad weekend for Nick. But we'll get on that later. Tony, on your article, I loved the Rocky tie-in when you began that. That really set the stage, you know. So that was. But let me ask you, can we get some captions on any of the pictures?
You know what, I was, and now that you brought that up, I didn't do that when I had sent it to Rich. I was just hoping that he would be able to get the pictures that way, that way we could have, you know, them for each fight, you know, so that the first fight after Yorgi, then those were the Yorgi pictures. But yeah, going forward, yeah, I can certainly do that. It was funny, because when I was writing the article last night, what was I watching? Rocky II. And I was like, you always need a good lead into an article. I was talking to Iceman John Scully today. He had sent something a few days ago. Rich, I don't know if he sent it to you or not, but it was something he wrote about Bernard Hopkins, and he was looking for people just to critique it, you know. And he was like, you know, this is the guy. He goes, I kind of like the way I talk, and he goes, but I want anybody, whether they're just a fight fan or a journalist or just someone that can sit down and, you know, just critique my work. So I emailed him today, and, you know, I said, I'll take a chance to look at it tonight, and I'll send it back to him. I said, because, you know, I have boxing, background, but I also have a journalism background. And I remember when I first started doing the boxing reporting, I was very cut and dry. I was very news reporter-ish, you know, if that's even a word. But it would be like, okay, Harry Yorgi's fighting this guy, Julius Kennedy. And I would just cover the fight. And then I started reading other people, and they were adding in anecdotes and little comments. And I was like, you know, I don't want to go too sensationalistic with it. I want to stick to, you know, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. But I want to make it more interesting. Tom, I'll have to send you one I wrote last year for a card I covered that was on NBC Sports. And just the little things that I was just putting in there, I sent it to Iceman today. Like one fighter had a great chin, and he was taking a beating, and I compared the, you know, his chin like LaMotta-esque.
There you go.
Or how his opponent was, trying to hit, like hitting the Rock of Gibraltar and things like that, and people really enjoyed that.
And as you mentioned, how Farmer was coming to the ring. He needed to shade his eyes from the glare reflecting from his outfit. Yeah, stuff like that. I mean, I think the essence of good writing is you want to bring the reader to the scene. And stuff like that is good, yeah.
And what was tough for me was my, education at Lock Haven University was very news reporting. It was like, I remember sitting in classes and they'd give you 6 or 7 statements or facts, you say, okay, we have like, and it was a made-up story, but okay, the body of a child was found in a dumpster, and this person said, listen, you'd have to turn it into an article. But it was very cut and dry. I had to cover the bouts for Lock Haven University's boxing team, which was difficult because I was on Lock Haven University's boxing team, and a lot of times I'm covering my own bouts. So, Dr. Cox really had, a heavy watch over my shoulder because, you don't want to go there and say, okay, this fight happened, blah, blah, blah. But the spectacular Tony Pennington got in the ring and his fight was going great. And, there's that little bit of potential bias for yourself. So, I became so very cut and dry. But now reading other people and just, the fact that, I go to the fight, and I'm watching a fight, I'm sitting there with 3 friends of mine, and, next thing you know, I'm cracking jokes about this one fighter, and I'm like, why don't I add that into my article?
Exactly.
But I'll tell you, the funniest part of the whole show from last week, it was a nice little place, about 2,000 people, it was a ballroom. Now, I got I didn't get the ring package, and I never get the press credentials because I like to go there as a fan. I like to cheer for a guy like Harry Yorgi, the friend of mine. Naeem Nelson is managed by another very good friend of mine. I want to cheer for these guys. I want to be a fan. I want to sit with my friends. So I got the general admission tickets, which were seated in the back. But for $31, you'd be a couple rows ahead. But they had girls bringing me free drinks. I was like, oh, shit, I'm doing that next time. Wouldn't have mattered last week because, I was still on medication, and I couldn't have drank anyway. But I'm like, oh, shit, next time, Rich, you didn't hear this. But my article the next time, I might be a little tipsy while I'm writing it.
Hey, that's okay because, I know from my years in higher academia, I wrote like an academic dork because that's what you need to do. But when you get into journalism, or I'll send you guys a link to my writing webpage, my copywriting page.
Yeah.
You want to write like you talk, and you want to put some excitement into it, some pizzazz. And everything doesn't have to be perfect, but I think for the fight crowd, we're not looking for everything grammatically esoteric, okay? It's just let's get down to it. And I like this. I like the whole thing. Now, June 15th. Go ahead.
June 15th, they announced that there's going to be another card there, which is great. This place is only about 30 minutes from my house, and they got a casino right there. So, I brought my mom with me. She has a membership to the casino. I have a membership to the casino, so I dropped her off. She met my one friend's girlfriend. They hung out, playing slot machines for a while. I tried to keep working at her tables. then when it was over, sure, I went up. I played some slots, you know. They got a couple of nice restaurants there. So it's a nice little place. If they can have more fight there, you're going to be talking to one happy Italian right here. Because I'll be there all the time. But what was also funny was my dad couldn't make the card last week. So I go there. I got two friends of mine. And my one friend's like, do you still have your dad's ticket? I'm like, yeah, I got it in my pocket. He goes, okay, listen, I'm going to go call my mom right now and have my son dropped off. Now, my friend's son is almost 17 years old. I've known the kid since he was a little kid, and I've messed with him all the time. And I told him I'm going to teach him how to box. So we're sitting there at the fights, and I'm joking around with him and all. Well, I happen to look a couple rows ahead of me is a professional boxer out of South Philly. And, Tom, you're going to love this. A couple years ago, I'm in Norristown, PA, which is a suburb, kind of northwest of Philadelphia. And I'm selling Christmas trees with some friends of mine, including the 17-year-old son of my one friend. And this guy comes to buy a tree. He's got his girlfriend with him. He sees my hat, which is a ringside hat. This is before I started wearing these goofy Santa hats. And he goes, are you into boxing? I said, yeah, I am. He goes, oh. So he goes, I'm a professional fighter. I said, oh, what's your name? He goes, Kamara Paisley. I said, I've covered your fights. I've seen you fight. Oh, really? Whatever. And I said, yeah, where do you train out of now? He goes, well, I train out of the Marian Anderson Rec Center in South Philly. I said, that's my old gym. I said, if you go down there, you'll see my picture on the wall. So we become Facebook friends, and I was talking to him a little bit. I see him at this fight card, so I go over and I'm talking to him, and we're BSing. So as we're talking, I got my Team Tornado boxing jacket on. This lady comes over, and she's like starstruck looking at us. So she said, excuse me, are you guys boxers? And we're like, yeah. These guys are like, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a two-time amateur All-American. I'm also a writer now. I train people. Oh, my God. She whips out a little, five-page program. She gets Kamara to sign it for her. And then she turns to me, you sign it. Absolutely. So I signed this lady's program. So my friend Stevie's standing there, 16, 17 years old. And I said, hey, lady, I said, see this kid right here? I'm going to start training him. And he's going to be better than all of us combined. Her jaw drops like she just saw the second coming of Sugar Ray Leonard. She was trembling and she turned to this kid who's never had a day of boxing training in his life. He turned to, would you sign my program? And tears laughing. Can I use your back as like a backboard? I'm like, yeah, sure. I didn't need everybody's back. Fine, use mine. They're even walking and shit. I'm like, are you writing this girl with your autobiography here? Dude, run your name and let's go. And then I was thinking about it back when I was about 17, 18-ish years old, before I really started boxing, but I had the gloves and stuff. And, sometimes me and my dad would hit the mitts just for fun, but I really didn't know what I was doing. I was down Jersey Shore at the one campground down there. We brought the gloves down, and I'm hitting the mitts. And these two kids, about 8, 9 years old, come over to watch me. Once again, I have no clue what I'm doing, but they didn't know that. So they asked for my autograph. So I got a sheet of paper and all that. And I'm writing like this inspirational, like, best of luck, stay in school, make all your dreams come true. Right now, somebody has an autograph, you either get my name, or if you're really lucky, you get a best wishes, too.
Yeah. There you go. Well, all right, Rich, what do you say? June 15th, are we going to make it down there for it? What do you think?
I don't know. We'll see. See if I get my money by then.
Okay, well, by all means, let's go. We got to do this, okay? We got to do this thing. We'll have a great time.
Why don't we just go Cinco de Mayo? Oh, no, it's the day before May.
The casino that it's at, it's not a big casino. It's the old Valley Forge Convention Center, which actually is where they held my high school graduation, of all things. But now it's got a couple of restaurants in there. It's got rooms, so that you can rent rooms. It's got a 24/7 casino.
Whoa.
If Rich gets the settlement, oh, Jesus Christ, we'll be all bumming off him.
Oh, right.
Which is going to be, you know, giving us money to play on the craps table and the blackjack table. Yeah.
All right. Nice. Sounds like a plan. June 15th, I'm going to start.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
We'll do it.
Yeah.
We'll do it. We've been waiting on this too long. We said when the weather gets warm, we got to do it.
Yeah.
I just had a another thought. I don't know if you guys remember this or not. I think I mentioned it on the air months ago, but I was thinking about it last week during that Timothy Bradley Ruslan Pergatnikov fight. There was a time in that fight. It kind of reminded me of the original Rocky, when both Rocky and Apollo were back in their respective corners, and both trainers were threatening to stop the fight. And both fighters were like, "No, fuck that! I want to keep fighting." I remember watching that fight last week. It was like Freddie Roach was like telling Pervatnikov, he goes, "Dude, I'm going to stop this fight." He goes, "Yeah, I'm going to stop it. You're getting hit too much." And Bradley's corner, they're telling him, "You know, we're going to stop this fight. You know, you're getting hurt. You're taking too many shots." And the fight that it just popped into my mind, and I don't know if you guys remember this, it was back around 1994-ish. I remember watching it live on ESPN. It was a world champion by the name of Prince Charles Williams, whose trainer, Marty Feldman, happened to be at the Saudi Twitch Casino last week. You know, he got in the ring and they announced him to the crowd. And a guy by the name of Murky Sosa, who fought James Toney, Roy Jones, fought everybody. And those two guys got in there on ESPN and beat each other so severely that after the seventh round, the referee stopped the fight and declared it a draw.
Wow.
Yeah. Tom, I swear, they found one corner of that ring, and for seven rounds, they stayed in that corner, and they just hit each other. They were right on each other's chests, no defense, no nothing, and they just hit each other. And I remember, Williams had, I think, a cut over, one of his eyes. I know his nose was bleeding. He looked grotesque. Sosa's eye looked like somebody put a football pump in there and blew it up. And after the seventh round, the referee stopped it and called it a draw. You know, he actually had to stop for both fighters. Neither could continue.
That would be some trivia to see how often that's happened in history. That is extremely rare.
Yeah.
Boy.
And then they fought a rematch like so many months later on the 4th of July weekend. I was at a picnic watching it, and Williams was ahead, and then Sosa caught him and then stopped him. But that was just the one thing out there. I said, I'll never forget this, watching those two guys. And it reminded me of that fight last week. At one point, it was like I was literally thinking that each cornerman is going to wave the towel at the same time.
Yeah, that's kind of reminded me of Ollie Frazier 3, you know, right before the 14th round, I think, or after the 14th, when Ollie was thinking of quitting. And, of course, Teddy Futch, as we know, wouldn't let Joe come out for the 15th round, and Ollie was just, wow.
I always wonder what would have happened, and I'm glad Eddie Futch stopped it. That's why he still goes down in my book as probably the greatest trainer in boxing history. Because not only did he know the sport, and he was great at game planning. I mean, you figure he took two fighters with completely different styles, that being Joe Frazier and Ken Norton, and he drew up a game plan for both of them to beat Muhammad Ali. That's saying something right there. And he trained a lot of other great fighters, you know, throughout his career. He mentored Freddie Roach and taught him a lot, you know, that Freddie uses now as a trainer. But I always wonder what would have happened if Eddie Futch would have let Joe Frazier at least stand up before that 15th round.
Yeah, very good question.
And I think he would have. I think, I think Muhammad, after it was over, I think he came out and said, and it was almost complimentary towards Joe Frazier. And I know they had their issues almost up until the time Joe passed away. But I think it was a situation where Ali, knowing that he finally won the day, wanted to give, without coming out and saying it, he wanted to give Frazier that one last bit of graciousness, saying, you know what, I wasn't coming out. I was going to stay on my stool, but they stopped it first.
Mm-hmm. I get the feeling you would have come out. But that's just my opinion. We'll never know. You know, and another fighter that Eddie Futch worked with, we forget about sometimes. Remember, he was working with Alexis Arguello for a while, which is a whole other style.
Really?
Yeah, he was in the corner of he was in the corner of Arguello in that Andy Gannigan fight that was just up and down. Almost that third round was like a movie. One of those movie fights. He's up, he's down, he's up, he's down. That, and Eddie Futch was in his corner then. So how about that?
I remember his work with Riddick Bowe, and obviously, but I think my favorite Eddie Futch
Smurf, didn't he?
My favorite Eddie Futch quote of all time was when he was training Marlon Starling. And, you know, Marlon, you know, I don't know if he was champ of the world yet or if he was ascending, you know, up the ladder. And the one day they said in camp, you know, Marlon was just, you know, not cooperating and he was mouthing off. And Eddie Futch looked at him and says, you know what, I've taught you everything you know, but I've yet to teach you everything I know.
Oh.
and humbled him right on the spot.
Yeah.
Well, since we're already on the topic of boxing, what do you think about this Bradley versus Provodnikov fight there? Did you guys see that fight?
I didn't, but I read about it and almost kind of wish I just went to that instead of the UFC in some ways, even though we had a decent card. But I understand, I don't know if it's fight of the year category. I'll let Tony answer that. He's seen it, but...
Close fight. Makes you wonder if Bradley's got somebody looking out for him with these scores being so close all the time.
Well, what do you think of the scoring, Tony?
With the scoring, I thought Bradley won. You know, my dad, he was arguing with me a little bit. He thought, well, I don't know about that scoring. The first two rounds, Bradley was hurt pretty bad in each round. And the first round, they incorrectly missed a knockdown. So that could have made that 10-8. The 12th round, Bradley did go down with a little second to go. And I remember somebody at that very moment tweeting, saying, is this Chavez Taylor all over again? But then Bradley got up and he survived the bell. And that was a 10-8 round. During the course of the fight, I think I had Bradley winning 8 of the 12 rounds. I had Provodnikov winning 1 and 2, and I had him winning another round somewhere in the middle. I don't remember which one it was. And then, of course, I had him winning round 12, 10-8. So with my scoring being 8-4, normally it would be 116-112. Obviously, you take a point away from Bradley for the knockdown. Now you're at 115-112. So even if you gave that other round a 10-8, it would be 114-112. Bradley would still win. Now, another judge had given Provodnikov, or two of the other judges had a 114-113. So they had given Provodnikov one other round, which I don't know which one it was. But with the knockdown, they still had Bradley winning 114-113. Now, if there was the first round 10-8, then the fight would have been 113-113 on two cards and would have been a draw. I thought Bradley won the fight by 3 points, 115-112. But here was my big concern. And someone actually watching the fight said it reminded them of Evander Holyfield, you know, a fighter sculpted perfectly, tremendous condition. And he uses his head as a third weapon sometimes. That even looks a little bit like a small version of Holyfield. But not a huge puncher. A lot of heart. easy to hit. And, Bradley, I mean, he was hurt a lot of times. I mean, there were times a lesser man would have been down and out. He does have a good chin. He does not have a great chin. And if he is becoming that easy to hit from a slower, more ponderous fighter, I'm afraid to see what's going to happen to him when he fights a guy like a Lucas Matisse, somebody on that caliber who's a little bit quicker and just as deadly as a puncher.
Do you think we'll be seeing a rematch with these guys?
I think there should be. Was a fight that, I think the fans have demanded. It was a good fight. It was a competitive fight.
Sound like Bradley wants it.
I think Bradley still has a lot to prove out there. Everybody's coming out there and saying he lost the Pacquiao fight, including me. I mean, I thought he lost 11 rounds to one, but he got the decision. That's coming up on a year now, and he's still not living that down. He still has to live with his fight with Devin Alexander, which was a heavily hyped fight that turned out to be a stinker. And it wasn't all Bradley's fault. I think it was even more Alexander's fault. But then he got the reputation of a dirty fighter because he was using his head in that fight. He was leading with his head. So you got the bad reputation coming off the Alexander fight, then going into the Pacquiao fight, which a lot of people thought he lost. So now he's gained some respect back because of the tremendous heart and determination he showed last week. But I think he still hasn't convinced people that he's a top, top-tier fighter, that he's a pound-for-pounder.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, great analysis.
There was a very interesting article on Yahoo about how Bradley kind of redeemed himself from the fate of, and his name eludes me, he was a Philadelphia fighter that lost to, that upset Eric Morales, I think, back in 2005. And then he fought. And then he fought Freitas. In fact, it was April 29th, 2006. I watched it in the motel room out in Limon, Colorado. I was driving out to Las Vegas. And he said that this fight was so important for Bradley because it kind of put him back on the map again, because he never just, it's like he pulled the upset, but he just wasn't able to capitalize on it. So it was pretty interesting if you guys get to see it on Yahoo. So,
well, big news in mixed martial arts this week. I got to change gears here. We have something I've been talking about for a while. We have the next episode of The Ultimate Fighter. It's going to be Ronda Rousey coached versus the coach being the winner of the Maisha Tate and Kat Zingano fight on April 13th on The Ultimate Fighter 17 finale. So I know I've been saying this even actually before they made the Zingano fight. That it's probably going to be Maisha Tate versus Ronda Rousey on Tough. Well, now they're going to do it. It's going to be co-ed, too.
What a circus. People, even in the mainstream, this is provoking a lot of laughs on ESPN or even Headline News, I think it was.
It makes you wonder, is this going to be the real world of MMA shows? Are we going to have fighters acting up with each other, men and women here?
Exactly. You could just imagine the drama that's coming on this. Well, we'll see how it plays out.
Same weight class, too. Same weight class, women and men, 135 pounders. Group of men and a group of women. I don't know whether they're going to coach both teams and they're going to train together or they're going to have different men's coaches too, but this is interesting.
Boy, you remember that old saying, you've come a long way, baby, but boy, just in the past couple of years here, how things have changed. And I wonder if it's the same weight class. I believe that Misha's boyfriend fights 135, doesn't he?
Caraway? Don't know.
Yeah. Wonder if he'll be there. Well, I would assume Misha would choose him for her.
I'm hoping it's her because we have her contact information from interviewing her before, so we'll have her back on the show.
Oh, yeah, this would be great.
The one that always still sticks out in my mind, though, 15 years ago. The other week, we were talking about women in boxing and women in MMA, and I was talking about at Lock Haven when we had one of the first female college fighters on our team, a girl by the name of Alyssa Ray, who I was on the team with, I helped train. Well, that year was one card. She didn't come with us. I didn't get her first out yet. But we were going up to State University in New York in Westchester. And it was the weekend of the Super Bowl. So it was late January, early February. And I'm going to I'm supposed to fight a kid from Mansfield. And I had gone up there the year before. My first win there against a kid from Westfield. So we're going up. I'm going to fight this kid from Mansfield. And as we're going up there, there is a wicked windstorm going on that day. And the Lock Haven team, we just crossed the Tappan Zee Bridge. And my dad and my actually my trainer from Philly was coming from, Kevin. They had just crossed the Tappan Zee Bridge about 15 minutes before we did. We crossed the Tappan Zee, and within like 10 or so minutes of us crossing the Tappan Zee Bridge, they shut the Tappan Zee down. So now we get up there, and we're finding out, Mansfield can't make it. I forget who else was supposed to be. There was like two schools that ended up not making it because of that windstorm. So now we get there, and the guy that would run the show was a guy by the name of Steve Acunto, who we had on our show about a year or two ago, personal friend of Rocky Marciano. And he's panicking because he would always have this weekend, and he would have this big like boxing scholarship dinner, and then he'd have this, fight card. And it was only about 7 or 8 fights on the card, maybe 10. And so we're up there, and now half of these guys aren't showing up. So I remember Dr. Cox was like, well, he had two guys, one guy at 119 and one guy at 125. They're going to fight each other in like kind of like an exhibition. Okay, no problem. He had me and another teammate of mine, Jason Pletcher. And Jason and I were good friends. We had class together. We used to hang out between classes and study. And we got along great. We're both sophomores. And I was about 2 weight classes above Jason. And the doctor said, well, we're going to have Penny Callum Pletcher go at it. And I remember Steve Acunto kind of looking like, my card's going to suck because right now we got two bouts with guys that are teammates. And I remember Doc was with his high, squeaky voice, No, Steve, don't worry about it. Listen, it's Penny Callum Pletcher. They really don't like each other. I'll tell you right now, they don't get along. So we looked at each other. We're like, yeah, Jason, we don't get along. And we laughed, but we went out there. We put on a good show. But there was one kid shows up with about 140 pounds. Kind of had long hair, kind of had like a little goatee going. He looked like he actually just came out of a trailer park, skinny arms with tattoos on him. And he's walking through there. His long hair was kind of like a mullet hairdo, but I can't talk bad about that because I had a mullet myself. But he's like, oh, fuck somebody up tonight. I'm going to kill somebody. I'm going to kick somebody's ass. Yeah.
Fear the mullet.
That's right. He's getting all fired up. I'm kicking somebody's ass tonight. Yeah. And he's sitting there, and he's like punching himself and getting fired up. Then he realized he had to box a girl. And this girl actually went on to a pro career. Her name is Denise Luttrell, and she was actually pretty good. So she gets in there with this kid. And now he's in a lose-lose situation because they're fighting a girl. And the thing is, she was more skilled than he was. And for the first two rounds, she's kicking his ass. So everybody in the crowd is alternately cheering for the girl and laughing at him. Especially wrestling type thing, like a guy versus a girl. Yeah, that's all scripted. And okay, yeah, and then like the girl wins or whatever. Oh, that's cute. That's funny. But look, what's the box like? This is real competition. And you can tell this kid's getting mad because people are laughing at him and he's getting his ass kicked by a girl. Well, he uncorked a haymaker in the third round and he knocked her on the seat of her pants. And everybody started booing him. Except for my trainer, Kevin. My trainer, Kevin, was like, he got up there cheering. He's like, fuck this woman's liberation shit. She gets in there, she's getting cracked in the mouth.
Right.
Here's how much stands out. 17 years later, I can still remember the guy walking in there, muttering to himself, and I can still remember him getting his ass kicked by a
girl. Wow. Well, it's going to be a freak show. Going to be an absolute freak show on that show. And speaking of the show, comments on Tuesday night, Rich?
The tough season is progressing pretty, in a pretty interesting area. I mean, it's just unbelievable that we got the wild card guy back, and it's one of the first people I interviewed on the show.
Yeah.
I got a lot of stuff in advance. And like I said, I've been saying, a black guy goes in the ambulance.
you were right. And I thought we had that classic stylistic matchup. In the first round, Casey was able to dominate on the ground, but he couldn't close the deal. He just couldn't finish it off.
Yeah,
the second round,
that was one of the closest fights. It was one of the closest fights in the tough season. But
I mean, I had it even up after two rounds, and you know, again, I'm hesitant to say anything because I don't know what his medical condition was, but it just seems like, damn, all the years you put into this. Go out on your shield, and I mean, I guess he just felt that he just couldn't keep
to make this fight a kickboxing fight, and I think Casey wanted to do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. That was it. That's all he wanted.
Sure.
That's all he had the strength left to do.
Mm-hmm.
He got cut up. He lost a lot of blood in his first two fights, so he's banged up to begin with going in this one. On top of that, you know, he'd already been called out. You know, this is the fight that Bubba wanted from the beginning.
Right. And again, I mean, I don't know what Casey was feeling, but, I mean, it just seems like get out there and just give it one last shot here rather than quit on the stool like that. It was, I don't know.
You look at it, too, with concussions. I mean, look at what happened with Bradley. I know he was talking and walking and seemed all right after his fight, but he had a concussion. And MMA, I think I'm going to talk about a little later when I read this, the suspensions, the medical suspensions from this last UFC card. But in MMA, you get a lot more injuries like that. So I think what happened was he's been banged up so many times, so many weeks in a row, that he was really in a bad way after all those strikes that he took in the second round. And I haven't watched it again, but the first time I watched it live, you know, well, even though it wasn't live, but I was thinking to myself, geez, he's taking a lot of shots, a lot of elbows, a lot of short shots. And the thing was, Bubba's coming in being conditioned to make it a kickboxing fight.
Right.
And Casey let him do that. He kept holding him tight and trying to go for the takedowns and stuff like that. So Bubba just kind of went into ground and pound jiu-jitsu. I mean, ground and pound striking mode and kickboxing. Just use those elbows like just basically like sledgehammers. And he didn't quite cut him up, but you got to remember all the other times in the previous fights that he's had. In his corner was yelling for those right-handed elbows. He gets in those positions a lot. So he was able to pull it out, and I think he might get to the next round, but it's going to take a miracle because they put him up against Uriah Hall, who has just been mowing everybody down.
Yeah.
And make it easy since his first fight. I think his first fight was one of the toughest we'll see this season.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll see, because I guess if you're there, you've got to be prepared to go through everyone if you want that contract. So.
Right. And then we have who else we have in the finals here? We got Kelvin Gastelum going against Corey Hart, I think it is, or Colin Hart.
Yeah, Colin, yeah. Yeah, two very aggressive guys and two guys pretty equal on the ground. This should be a pretty good stylistic clash. Looking forward to it.
And then the guy who's really flying under the radar, the last pick of all the fighters, Dylan Andrews, is going up against Luke Barnett, who is, in my opinion, has got to be the show favorite. Got to be.
So, yeah, we got the first pick against the last. Yeah, that's interesting.
And then the third fight by elimination almost is Josh Salmon and Jimmy Quinlan. And there was a funny little bit when those two basically made their fight, made an agreement to fight in the Ultimate Fighter house kitchen.
Yeah, yeah.
Very agreeable. Like, why don't we fight? And okay, yeah, let's fight. And this was really funny. Was that after that little confrontation they had, I think Barnett asked him, you know, why'd you do that? And he goes, oh, I just feel like going fishing because the guy's name is Salmon.
Yeah, I love Salmon, my favorite fish. Yeah.
Salmon versus Jimmy Quinlan. So I think that should be an interesting fight. Those guys are both a little bit under the radar too.
Yeah. Now, I understand the ratings have been better than the prior season.
Right. And this is by far the most interesting and skilled cat we've seen.
Right, right.
Really, ever.
I would agree, and it'll really be interesting when Rhonda and I can't say for sure. I don't know much about that Catwoman, but assuming Misha gets past her, we'll see what the ratings are like for that. I mean, because I think Rhonda has that cross. What's the word I'm looking for? It transcends the sport, you know, one of those things that you can draw on a lot of casual folks. Just for Rhonda, so we'll see how that one goes. And then, did you catch the robot? You guys watching the Robot Combat League? Freddie Rhodes shows up. Freddie Rhodes shows up for some instruction, huh?
Yeah, they finally aired that episode. I caught that. It's kind of nice because now, right after the Ultimate Fighter, the Combat League is on, so I know to watch it.
Yeah,
I think they did that. But those robots are getting more and more interesting, and, you know, when stuff flies off and hydraulic fluid shoots into the stands, it gets a little bit more interesting.
Yeah.
And sparks and stuff. But I don't know. I don't know if they're quite that advanced yet that they're going to take over real combat sports. But I bet it's going to be like, you know, those asteroid movies, you know, once one comes out, another one's going to come out right after it, so.
We'll see what it's like 30 years down the road, you know. This will be interesting.
But at least
we'll be able to say we were there when the whole thing began, just like we can go back to 93. Yep, we were there when it began.
That's amazing because they're both. They look like Rock'em Sock'em robots. And we know that game was made in like what, the 50s.
Yeah.
The game was made forever ago to me. I mean, I had it when I was a kid, and I know, you know, my uncles had it when they were a kid. So that's exactly what they are. Basically, is Rock'em Sock'em robots.
Yeah.
And it's just a larger version. So you wonder why it took so long for them to do it. But they've done it, and it's pretty technologically advanced.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see him do it with one controller, though. One person, like, running on a treadmill instead of the dude controlling the legs.
Yeah, because then you get that controversy and the trouble between the two, like last week. And I think that was a little bit of a gift decision there. You know, they had the whole ploy of the girl and her son and all that, you know, but... she had a little bit of drama with the engineer that was the backup guy. Yeah, that was pretty interesting too. But well, we'll see what subsequent seasons. Well, of course, who knows if it'll stick around. But I don't know what the ratings are like for this. I haven't heard anything about it.
Well, I think you might have to have weight classes the next time they do it because that robot was way bigger.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah, very good point.
And they even said before the match he was the heaviest robot in the competition. So that was actually the first fight that I saw where there was like physical dents in the chest armor of the opponent.
And then how about when the hydraulic fluid went spewing all over the guy's face that was trying?
Yeah.
To, oh, what a mess that would be!
But that's different. I mean, that's what makes that type of boxing different than human boxing. I mean, in that situation, imagine a human fighting with an exposed tendon. You just punched it enough times, it would squirt. You know, you're going to have a lot more fight stops because of that stupid shit than you are, you know, real damage.
Yeah, I
don't
even think
they have even punching power yet, or punching angles, or anything like that. You see these people take these weird loop and swing. None of them seem to know how to really fight.
Well, that's
so,
what they had Freddie Roach in there for. And you know, I guess some of those guys, you know, some of the earlier shows, a few of them said they had some experience in Muay Thai, and I don't think and a few MMA guys. I don't think we've had any pure boxers in there. But really, boxing is the discipline you'd want to have in this kind of thing. So,
yeah, these robots don't have jabs. They just don't have them.
Yeah. Yeah. Come in, try to work the body, and throw those haymakers, and go from there.
Body, head, yeah. No. Body, maybe one head with the other hand.
Yeah. Because I keep wanting to, come on, snap that jab, get that jab going. No, I don't think it's that kind of, it's not set up like that. Because I'm so used to thinking in boxing, the most important punch is your jab, but in robot combat, I can't say that.
Well, I mean, you do it with hydraulics.
Tony, are you catching any of that robot combat league?
I haven't seen it, no. Well, I can just imagine, but like I said, I can imagine it being like a large version of Rock and Sock and Robots. Not much skill involved, just, you know, win the right to one explodes.
Yeah, I'm sure it's on YouTube somewhere by now. So.
Well, no, they have reruns of it every night on Sci-Fi. So if you feel like getting caught up in it, Tony, you can check next week on the Sci-Fi Channel, because it's the new episode's Tuesday at 10. But then they have.
I think Tony's afraid to watch it. He doesn't want to watch it because I told him it was going to take over boxing.
Come on. Well, you know, coincidentally, another article that I found, I was on a Yahoo Kick today, and there was a neurologist talking about how he's sure boxing's going to be banned, and I'll have to send you guys the link to that. That was they had lots of stuff on there, but yeah, so if boxing's banned, and I remember there was a Twilight Zone episode, the original Twilight Zone back in the early 60s, where boxing had been outlawed and they had moved into the future, and the future was 1974, and they just had androids in there fighting, and Lee Marvin was an ex-fighter, and his machine broke down and they needed money, so he actually got in and fought the robot. I won't spoil the outcome in case you guys haven't seen it.
I have never seen it, but maybe that's where they got the real steel idea.
Yeah, that's probably on YouTube too. I'll have to check that one to see if I can send that one to you guys.
Anyway, well, we got a couple of minutes here. We're gonna have to give Chop Chop Corley, Demarcus Corley, a call in a few minutes here, about 3 minutes away from that. I did want to mention a very interesting story outside of boxing, outside of MMA, going all the way to Croatia, Zagreb. Croatia, we had the K1 in his debut. Krokop finally did it. He won the K1 Grand Prix 2013. Just mowed through all the competition in his home country. Defeated Ismael Mont in the finals. Along the way, he also defeated Jarrell Miller and Pavel Zurlev, all by decision.
Well, good for him.
Back in MMA. I don't know if it's going to be the UFC, but interesting, very interesting. And I don't know if you guys heard about this, but HBO is cutting ties with Golden Boy. And you know, this comes at an interesting time. Golden Boy fighters are connected fighters. I mean, you go up to Floyd Mayweather, you get Bernard Hopkins, Adrian Broner. We got another Adrian Broner story later. He got arrested. Not to talk about that, but we have to connect any second here with Demarcus Corley. But Bernard Hopkins, of course, coming off a big win. Just losing the chance to get him in a fight. I guess, from issues with Steven Espinoza. He is actually a Showtime executive now. He was the former legal representative for Gold Boy. So they think that's why Floyd Mayweather made the deal with Showtime and everything like that, because of the connection there with Espinoza being connected to Golden Boy. And that just kind of caused the floodgates to open. All the other guys went to Espinoza, who were working with Golden Boy, and started to work out Showtime deals, I guess. So that's an interesting backstory to it.
Well, I noticed, it looks like Chop Chop had went over to Russia to fight Ruslan. I didn't know that. I'm just looking at his record now. I'll get a comment from him on that.
Yeah. Ukraine, Victor Postol fight. Tony just told me he just fought him.
Hey.
Marcus, how's it going?
Hey. It's going good. How you doing?
Good. Ramble Rouse and Rich Bergeron. We also have Tony the Tornado Fennecal on the line and Psychic Tom Padgett.
Good evening, Marcus.
Hey, good evening. How y'all doing?
Good.
Great. So tell us, first of all, how did you first get into the fight game?
Hanging down the rec center, looking through the doors, and I seen them in there practicing.
Mm-hmm.
And, Coach walked up to me and asked me, did I want to box? And I told him no. And he said, wow. Well, I told him I already know how to fight. And he said, boxing is different than fighting. I said, what's the difference? You throw punches and you hit someone and you get hit. He said, well, boxing is a sport. And I said, well, what do you get if you win? And he took me in the office and showed me a trophy case. And he said, most of the time, you win or lose, you get a trophy or a medal. And that was enough for me. I went home and I begged my mother to let me box. And she insisted on me not being a boxer. And the reason she didn't want me to fight because I have asthma. I was born with asthma. And I begged her and begged her for a couple of months. And eventually, she gave in and said, go ahead, you can try it. And I was 10 years old then. I had my first fight when I was 11.
Awesome. And what do you enjoy most about the sport?
The most I enjoy about it is fighting. I love fighting in the ring. Outside the ring, it's not nothing to me. I don't worry about that because I only had one fist fight my entire career being a professional fighter and an amateur. So I'm very humble, quiet, and you wouldn't know I was a fighter unless you knew who I was.
All right. You fought a lot of big names in the sport, of course. Floyd Mayweather Jr., obviously the biggest name out there. Ruslan Provodnikov just fought this last weekend. You fought some pretty big names. Who would you say was the toughest guy you've ever fought?
The toughest? I would say Lucas Matisse. He's the toughest. Floyd wasn't the toughest. I mean, he's the most skillful fighter I ever fought and one of the best fighters, but he wasn't the toughest.
Mm-hmm. All right. Tony was going to ask a question. Tony.
Yeah, well, okay. Rich, you were saying what was making a fight with Matisse tough, so we'll let the Marcus answer that, then I'll step in.
Say that again?
What made the fight with Lucas tough, the toughest?
His size and his aggressiveness of me taking that fight on a short notice, and I watched the fight with Zab Judah, and I knew that we can box this guy, but I didn't know he was that physically strong.
All right. Go ahead, Tony.
It's funny, DeMarcus, because we were talking about Matisse earlier in the show. Obviously talking about last week's fight on HBO with Timothy Bradley and Ruslan Provodnikov, which was a very good fight back and forth. Provodnikov had Bradley hurt a few times. And the one thing I remember coming out saying earlier in the show was Ruslan's a very good fighter. He's strong, he hits hard, but I think Bradley was, I think, a little bit too macho for his own good. And the fighter that I said that I would fear for him to fight was Lucas Matisse today, because he is a little bit, I mean, at least on paper, you would know you were in there with both of them, but he seemed like he was just a little bit a better skilled boxer than Provodnikov is.
True. And I don't see them two fighting each other no time soon right now, because they're looking for Lucas to fight the winner between Danny and Zach. Ruslan is not the steel waiting in line to fight someone else and put on a great performance.
And actually, when we were going over your record today before we got you on the air, Rich and I had a little bit of confusion. We were talking about the your last opponent, Victor Postol, which you fought over in the Ukraine. And I was talking about him because he actually fought today against the guy.
Yeah, he beat Hank Lundy.
Yeah, and Hank is a very good friend of mine from Philadelphia. We used to train out of the same gym in South Philly. What can you tell us about, because I haven't talked to Hank yet, obviously, but what can you tell us about Victor Postol out there?
His height is a major factor for him being at the 140-pound division. He knows very well how to use his reach and his height. And when we fought the 12-round decision, we fought the perfect fight. I mean, when I got inside his house, he found a way to get me outside, hold me, tie me up. I hurt him a couple of times, but when I did hurt him, he still found a way to grab, hold me, the rest would break when I got him inside. He fought the perfect fight. He used that jab to the teeth.
And you got to fight him in the Ukraine, which is obviously where he's from, right?
Yeah. Well, over there, if you don't get a knockout, you're not going to win your dollars. If you go to distance, you lost.
Exactly. That's what I was looking at the scores when he fought Hank today, and it was, I think, 116, 112, 8 rounds before, and 116, 113, which I guess is 7, 4, and 1. And that's the first thing I said to Richards. I said, I don't know. Over in Ukraine, I don't know. I don't know how much home cooking there was with that.
I don't know. I haven't seen the fight.
Yeah, Alex, I'll talk to Hank when he gets back to Philly.
Do you have anything cooking, DeMarcus, on a next fight?
I'm knocking on the door, begging Luda Bella to get me a fight at 135. We're not fighting at 40 no more. I'm moving down to lightweight. He said he really don't have no 35 pounds out there in his stable. And trying to fight somebody else from another stable is very hard because they don't want to take the risk. I'm getting beat by an older guy who's coming down in weight.
Well, Bernard Hopkins just proved age is just a number, right?
Right.
It's all how you treat your body, how you take care of it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you had a favorite punch that you like more than any other punch?
Well, I think you would know that. And you want me to answer that for you? You know it.
Sure. Well, tell us what you like.
My right hook. Yeah. I mean, everybody look at all southpaws. They have a great left hand, and they always look out for the straight left hand. But, I mean, me, everybody know I have no reason to hide it. They know Chuck is going to throw that right hook. If I hit you with it, you know what's going to happen.
I always like the hooks myself. I think I only boxed in college, but even with the headgear on, if you knew how to throw a good right hook or left hook to any fighter, they were going to feel it. And you see, most of the knockouts, when somebody gets hit in the chin, it's a hook. You know, that's what kind of really knocks the brain against the skull, which gives you the knockout. You catch somebody right on that chin, and they're going down. Happens in MMA too. Same concept. But what do you think about the development of boxing over the years? You've seen a lot of it, how far it's come and all that. What do you think about where we're at today in boxing?
I think boxing was better back in the 70s and the 80s. Better class of fighters. But now, I mean, this is a totally new era that's coming about. You got Adrian Bruno, you got Mayweather about to retire in a couple more years. All these young fighters, a lot of fighters are just doing things illegal. They're taking drugs, they're taking enhancements, and they're getting more. So it's really messing the sport up. But I think last week's fight that I seen with Ruslan and Timothy Bailey was one of the best fights I ever seen since Marvin Hagler and Sugar Ray Leonard back in the day.
Awesome. I think what hurts boxing a lot these days is the fact that, you know, you have a lot of titles out there, and the top guys aren't forced to fight each other unless they're under a promotional contract. You know, with Bob Arum or Golden Boy or Don King, you know, you can avoid it. You can avoid the top guys. And when they were talking about for years the potential Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, and even a couple of years ago, I remember coming on this very show and saying, I can tell you right now it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because the guys have a tremendous incentive that they can you know, win, they can get a reward, but I think they are too afraid to take the risk to get that reward. You know, Mayweather is undefeated, and he can come out there and say, I'm the best boxer of all time. Nobody's ever beaten me. And he didn't want to put that, you know, risk against such a dangerous opponent. Pacquiao, who's now lost two straight fights, at the time, you know, he still is. You know, he's a political giant over in his influence. He's a singer. He's a god to these people. And it was too much risk of him getting knocked off that pedestal. And the two fighters I always think of that were not afraid to take that risk back in 1981 were the prime Sugar Ray Leonard and the prime Thomas Hearns, two of the greatest welterweights ever. They were not afraid to step in that ring 15 rounds to see who the better man was.
Right. And back then, they guaranteed rematches. Now in a fighter fight, he ain't guaranteed a rematch. They don't make sure you got a rematch clause in your contract. So if you lose, you don't get a shot back at it. Your title's gone. I experienced that when I fought Brad Judah.
Now, what would you say is your best moment so far in the sport?
My best what?
Your best moment ever so far in the sport.
Winning the world title in the first round knockout. 2 minutes and 49 seconds.
That's a pretty nice moment.
And I took that fight on a 5-day notice.
I remember that fight. I remember you put him down twice. And then, like I said, I remember them even talking about you coming in on a short notice and just taking
a few out of right on Boxrec.
Was that on HBO or Showtime? Because I remember watching it.
That was Showtime.
Showtime? Because it was actually right after I had moved, and we just got our cable hooked up, and I was staying in that night. We had just moved 5 days prior. And I'm like, man, I'm staying in tonight. I'm tired with all the movement and a further commute to work. And I remember watching, that was the first fight I watched after I moved to my new house.
This is interesting, too, because it says the guy who had the title had to relinquish it because of a routine eye exam revealed that he had cataracts. And then you had your next fight against this same guy, Errolio.
Had to give him a rematch.
So I guess he didn't have cataracts. I don't know. What happened?
He did eye surgery, but it was still a rematch because he was number one. He was the champion, and by him having to relinquish his title, he was guaranteed to fight the winner. But I fought Indy Julio in 1999 for the USBA title.
All right.
Yeah.
So you had some experience against him.
Yeah, that was my first 12-round fight.
And, of course, you had you've had some battles with Randall Bailey, who's had some pretty tough fights himself. Some memorable brawls.
Yeah, right. He can punch.
Yeah.
Got a hell of a right hand to hear.
Yeah. Everyone is questioning now, can he still pull the trigger?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mike Jones found that out last year the hard way.
Yeah.
Go to one of our former guests, Francisco Figueroa, I think. We had a show one time talking about it.
Yeah, I was trying to fight him off, so.
All right.
I mean, we're looking right now. We're trying to get the fight with Ricky Burns. If Eddie Hearns want to do it, I talked to Luda Bell and matchmaker Joe Kwame and put it out there. They're looking for an opponent for Ricky Burns, May 11th. I'll be willing to fight him if they want to fight at 135 because he don't have an opponent now.
Right. Now, who are your favorite fighters of all time and who are out there right now?
Of all time, at first, I would go with Pernell Whitaker.
Good choice.
Sitting right on the pedestal with Pernell. Got to be Marvin Hagler. Without no doubt, Hector Macho Camacho Senior, one of my idols. He's one of the reasons why I started wearing the stuff that I wear.
Nice.
Sugar Ray would be fourth on the list, and then I would probably move from there and come into the 20th century. It would have to be Floyd Mayweather, Adrian Broner. I really don't care too much for Manny Pacquiao. He's a southpaw, but he don't impress me.
He's losing his advantages, I think, because he's been a little bit figured out. But there was a lot of close decisions there with Marquez, and to end up getting knocked out by Marquez the way he was, that was a big turning point in his career.
Well, Golden Round comes around. They say Marquez won the night fight. Mm-hmm. They didn't give it to him.
Yeah, that was an interesting one because I watched that with the British announcers. And they were all for Marquez. And I was right along with them, just watching their commentary. And then I watched the American version from the HBO feed because I watch them online when I watch the big fights. And it was all for Manny Pacquiao. So I kind of saw the fight for him. So I was wondering, well, am I getting that swayed by the announcers or is it just because I'm watching it a second time? That was an interesting fight. It definitely could have gone either way.
Another great fight, Manny Pacquiao and Timothy Bradley. I thought Manny won the fight.
Yeah, I did too.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he won.
I was so suspicious, too, because they already had Bradley come out with the rematch poster. Because there was going to be a rematch. Before the fight, he comes out with the rematch poster. I thought that was very sketchy.
I was actually on an online conference the other day, and they were talking about Manny Pacquiao and where he goes from here. And one thing I said, and I used the Bradley fight as one of my examples, but I said I feel that he started losing his passion for the sport probably around mid to late 2010. Because I remember the fight when he fought Cotto in 2009, and he was well ahead on the cards going into the 11th and 12th round. He had him down once or twice. He's way ahead on the cards, and all he had to do was last 6 more minutes, and he wins the fight easy. And he went out there like a ball of fire, and he had his opponent hurt, and he finished the show. He knocked him out. A year later, he's fighting Margarito, and he's beaten Margarito up pretty good, and he's way ahead on the cards going into the last few rounds. And he had the man lumped up, and instead of closing the show like he did to Cotto, he pulled back, and he let him off the hook. He let him go the 12 rounds. When he fought Shane Mosley, he had Mosley's legs were gone.
Bosey's in the corner, you know, he was saying, you know, I'm done. I don't got nothing left. And he didn't finish the show against Mosley. I felt that was part of his problem against Bradley. I thought he won the fight, but he could have been more impressive, especially when the man sprained his ankle. And I go into that Martinez fight. I remember saying it on the air with these guys, and I said, Martinez is going to win this fight, I think partially because I think he has Pacquiao's number and he knows just how to neutralize him, but also because Manny doesn't have that hunger and that passion that he did back around 2007, 2008, 2009. And that's what's going to... And I said, his mind's not there anymore. And after that right hand, his mind definitely wasn't there anymore.
Well, the thing about him was his offensive style, Pacquiao. It was almost like, you know, the basic steps of karate. You know, you bring your hand back to your chest instead of back to your chin. And he was such an offensive fighter, he forgot about defense a lot. He forgot to bring the hands back to the chin. And I saw a lot of fights where he took a lot of damage, and it didn't really go much noticed. But it finally caught up to him because he looked like he had a good chin, but all it takes is one good punch when you're not guarding yourself. That's it. So I think that's where he really needed the most work, but... Getting back to you, DeMarcus, do you have any role models or people that really helped you out outside the sport?
One of my role models would be Sugar Ray Leonard. That was my manager when I first turned pro for my first 4 years of my career. I was with Ray, and I learned a lot from him. Got a chance to spar with him for the Hector Camacho fight that he had lost. But I learned a lot from Ray, and then going to camp with Premier Whitaker. In 1997, working with him, spawned with him, Vernon Flores. I've been there with a lot of legends and great fighters over the years of me coming up in professionally. And I just take my hat off to all them fighters.
All right. And who out there today would go ahead, Tony.
Well, I was going to say, earlier you named some of, you know, the fighters you enjoyed watching, you know, from you know, past years and currently, and two of the fighters you mentioned happen to likely be the best defensive fighters of their generations, that being Pernell Whitaker and Floyd Mayweather, fighters you rarely see get hit with solid punches, but both have different defensive styles. What do you like about their different defensive styles, and what do you think you know, you've kind of emulated over the course of your career?
What I like the most about Pernell Whitaker, he would flick with his defense. I mean, he would get close to you and make you miss because he didn't want to get hit. And he was a showmanship fighter. He loved to show that he can do this like it's nothing. With Floyd, his defense is his offense. And that's what makes him a good fighter, on top of his counterpunching, his accuracy. He didn't have great punching power at 135, 140. But over the years went by, he has developed punching power, and he's now putting guys away.
Tom, you got anything? You've been pretty quiet over there.
Yeah, I'm just listening, just learning. Well, DeMarcus, first off, congratulations on an outstanding career. I mean, you've fought them all, you've fought everyone, you've fought everywhere, and I salute you for that. And a lot of times fighters will, after they've been in the game for a bit, they have what I refer to as one of those aha moments where they realize that they can really be something special at this sport. Now, obviously, you were something special, and do you recall a moment when you really felt you could make it to the highest levels, and if so, could you describe that moment? Well, did you get to the point where all of a sudden you just knew that you were going to the highest levels of the sport? Because I think when you first get into something, you don't know how you're going to do, And can you remember that moment when you felt, yeah, I know I can be a champion?
Mm-hmm. Wow, I just did a questionnaire yesterday about a question similar to this one. And I had to go back to 1992 in the Eastern Trials. I was 18 years old, I think. I fought a young fighter named Julian Wheeler. And he was from the Army team, Fort Bragg, I think it was. First round, I always had a great first round, but me, I didn't push it to the limit because of my asthma, so I tried to coast the second and prepare myself for the third so I wouldn't be going into overdrive. And I fought Julian Wheeler in the Eastern Trials, and I didn't know I was that close to Barcelona. If I would have beat Julian Wheeler, I would have went to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Who do I see fighting Julian? Who do I see fighting Julian Wheeler on TV? Oscar De La Hoya.
Wow. Yeah.
Right then and there, when I watched that fight, that let me know that I could become something if I put my mind to it.
Wow.
So I did. After that, I took off. I didn't fight no more in 92. Didn't fight in 93. I didn't fight none in 1994. I started training again in 1995. I prepared myself for the National Golden Gloves. I had 36 fights in 1995. I won 30 out of 36 fights. Went to the National Golden Gloves, won the National Golden Gloves, went to Colorado Springs. Who I run into? Fernando Vargas.
Luck of the draw, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
You got the decision. Yep. But at that moment in 96, preparing for the Olympics in Atlanta, when I lost to Fernando, I really looked back at the sport and said, I learned a lot and I see how the amateurs are. It was already pretty much fixed who was going to the Olympics. They had their team picked. So if you didn't dominate knockdowns and knock the guy mouthpiece out, because they started the computer scoring system then, they wasn't judging the fights the way they used to.
Oh, yeah. It's a whole other story.
So I decided to turn pro at the Olympics in May, just before the Olympics started, matter of fact. May 17th on Sugar Ray Leonard's birthday, to be exact.
Nice.
Pro debut.
I like working with Sugar.
It was great. I learned a lot. He's a very quiet, humble, observing guy. He observed everything. He doesn't do a lot of talking when he's around, but he sat back and observed and watched.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was kind of a thinking man's fighter in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think he'd be thinking when he's around. He'd be studying people, studying how they are when he's sitting around them, seeing what type of person they are.
Oh, I'm a guy from the area where Rocky Marciano and Marvin Hagler came up, right next to it. I used to live the town over from Brockton. And, so I saw a lot of their humble beginnings and all that, and, saw where they came up through. I actually boxed in one of the gyms that Marvin came through. And I read a lot about the whole lead-up to the Marvin Hagler fight. Sugar Ray picked a perfect time to fight Marvin. He did not get him at his prime, and he had a lot of conditions that he made sure went his way. He picked the size of the ring, which was very important to that fight and his strategy. He didn't leave anything to chance except for, maybe a knockout punch out of nowhere from Hagler, but he fought the best fight he possibly could in the best possible conditions. According to what I've read and the people I've talked to who are actually in his corner at certain points. Very smart guy. And he knew. He knew when he had lost a step. I think it's kind of like the way Floyd set up Manny Pacquiao. Just kept refusing to fight him until he lost. And I said, I don't have to fight him now.
Exactly.
Interesting. what is your ultimate goal in the sport?
Right now we're looking to fight maybe two more fights this year, try to get a title shot at 135. But my goal is I'm working toward putting my shoe on the shelf in the shoe stores. That's my dream. That's one of my visions. To be not to be the first fighter, but the only fighter to ever come out with his own line of boxing shoes. And have it just sitting on store shelves and being purchased by all the young fighters that are coming up.
Nice. Well, could happen. For sure. I know, actually, when I went out to Vegas not too long ago, I was looking online and I saw that Mike Tyson was having an autograph signing. And I had gone out and got some boxing gloves out there earlier in the year, and I got Muhammad Ali's signature series gloves. They had his signature on it, you know, but it wasn't like, you know, a real signature, obviously. It was printed right on the glove.
Right.
So I brought that one to Tyson because they give you, they make you pay like $300 for an autograph from him, but they give you these stupid little toy gloves. And I said, no, I want a real boxing glove that has Muhammad Ali's signature on it. So that's the one he signed. But that might be an idea for you. Signature series. You may make a little, may put your signature right on it. That sounds like a good plan. A lot of boxers don't think outside of the sport early enough in their careers, you know. So it's good to, to hear you got a plan for something like that. Do you have a prototype yet?
I'm past the prototype. I have the shoes in stock. A couple of fighters have already worn, fought in them, trained in them. Bernard Hopkins trained in them for his last fight. He trained in three different pairs. Steve Cunningham, he fought in the pair when he fought over in Germany. Youssef Mack, he had the pair. Shane Mosley tried to blame a pair on his fight with Shane Mosley.
Uh-oh.
Those were my shoes that he fought in.
Not good publicity.
He tried to blame it on the shoes, all the running he'd done.
Oh, no.
Vlad Judah, he has two pairs. Devin Alexander has a pair. They all love my shoes. They train in them.
Next time he says anything, say, well, Nike has some good waffle racers you can get for running.
If I had it my way, I like to fight them just for making that type of excuse. Fighters, you don't make excuses. You lose, you lose.
The shoe fight. That would be some good animosity to start with there.
I'd be watching.
Yeah. Well, so
let's say he's been fighting and he's done.
What sets your shoes apart from the stock shoes that are out there now?
I have a better looking shoe and a better comfortable shoe. My shoe is more comfortable than any other Manny Pacquiao Nike they got out there, the Adidas, the ASIC, the Pumas. My shoe is more comfortable. And if you put a shoe on and put one of them on and work out in it, you'll see the difference. You'll be, you're lying. You're right.
All right. Do you have a website or anything out there for any of this stuff?
Oh, we built the site again. It was up. It was Corey Sports Apparel. The site is down, but it should be back up by the end of this year.
All right.
You can go to my Facebook page. I got photos and images all on Facebook, all on my Instagram.
Well, tell people how to find you online anyway. Anybody you want to give a shout-out to now, I guess it's a good time to do that.
You can find me on Chop Corley at Twitter, DeMarcus Corley at Yahoo. That's my email address. My Instagram is Chop Chop Corley. And my Facebook also is DeMarcus Corley.
All right. You got any final thoughts or anybody else out there you want to give a shout-out to?
I'd like to thank y'all, first of all, for bringing me on, doing this interview, talking with you. to any other 135-pound champions out there or top 10 contenders. If you're not afraid to fight me, beg your manager to give you a shot at a former world champion at 135. I know you'd rather say, you'd rather go up the street and cross and go safe, but eventually you're going to have to cross this road.
Awesome. Well, thanks for spending some time with us here tonight, DeMarcus, and we wish you the best of luck, although I'm sure you probably won't need it. You got some skill there following you through here. You follow a lot of tough guys. I think you're ready to keep it going. So looking forward to seeing you get something.
Appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
We'll keep
good
in
luck,
touch
DeMarcus.
All right. Have a good night.
All right,
so there you have it, DeMarcus Corley. Chop, chop. Check him up. Check him out.
I like that old school attitude. You know, when you lose, you lose. Don't blame it on the shoes. You know, it's really
that's awesome, though. That would be such a great fight to hype.
that would be the motto for it.
You made fun of my shoes, you know. People get shot for that stuff in some communities. That's serious stuff.
When you lose, don't blame it on my shoes. That's
Bob Nutley would have had a lot of fun with right there.
Yeah.
I used to have a running joke down at my old gym. You know, we would go there and like anytime somebody and like I said, we always kept it as a joke. I know some places would do shit like this seriously, but like say you went there with a nice piece of workout outfit on or a nice pair of boxing shoes, and like especially me and my trainer would always do this to them. And they're like, hey, nice shoes you got there. Thanks. Box your form. And like I said, we always kept it, you know, as a joke. Some places I know we get serious about that shit. But he had a pair of shoes he got one time. They were about 3/4 length. So they weren't the full calf ones, but they weren't the high top sneaker looking ones either, which is kind of I wear now, especially when I'm training. These are about 3/4 and they were black. And they had tassels built right into them, like going all the way around them. I came in there one day and he had them on. I looked at him and I said, oh, we ain't joking about this. I will box you for them. Well, he had small feet. They were like size 9.5. I'm like, you gotta be shitting me. The one day I would box him for something that I'd really want, it wouldn't fit my big ass feet. And it's not that I have, like, long feet. I just have real wide feet.
Oh.
So, like, yeah. I have to get, like, when I get my shoes, I have to literally get, like, a size or two larger just because my feet are so wide.
I blamed, like, a blister on a hike on my shoes, but I never blamed the fight on my shoes. It was a fight, so. But anyway, we got to talk about UFC 158. We've alluded to it, but we've not run through the card. We got 7 minutes of the show left. We got George St. Pierre obviously beat Nick Diaz, unanimous decision on all cards, on all judges' scorecards. Nick Diaz tried. I mean, I'll give him that, but I think the big thing, he needs to watch Rocky Marciano, I think. Because Rocky Marciano had that same little pawing thing that he used to do. But guess what? He punched after he did it. He didn't just paw you and back away. That was the thing where the best story I've ever heard on this is Rocky's trainer brought a real cat to the dinner table. Was talking to Rocky about boxing. And he's playing with the cat with the string, and he says, watch this, Rocky. Watch how the cat sizes it up with one paw, and then he comes and hits it with the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch the knockout of Jersey Joe Walcott, it's exactly what Rocky did before he hit him with that right hand. He was left out there, paw and jab. Literally, that's why they call it a pawing jab, because it comes from a cat. and that's the way he would set up his punches. Now, Nick Diaz could do that, but he just wasn't throwing the punches that he needed to throw when he had the opportunity to throw them. George St. Pierre was kind of throwing them all over the cage at certain points and keeping them down. So those moments where he had on the feet, he managed to damage St. Pierre with just a few punches. Tooled him up good, but I kept begging for him to throw more punches when he was on his feet. He should have realized, this is my chance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, aside from all the other stuff that he did after the fight that we could write a book about. That bugged me the most. He did not throw the follow-up punches to doing that. I mean, if you're going to grab a guy's hand like that or pretend to, you got to have something that comes after the distraction to make your fighting style effective.
Yeah, and I think in the third round, and for a bit in the fourth round, he would have had the chance to change the momentum a bit had he done a little more of that, but not the way it went.
And apparently, all kinds of stories come out today. Last few days, George St. Pierre was feeling sick before this fight. George St. Pierre had an Achilles injury. I mean, more excuses than somebody who loses a fight.
Well, and then of course we had the infamous hand wrap controversy. You heard about that one, or did you?
No, I have not.
Okay,
well, heard about that.
Well, Jake Shields, they were doing a lot of head games here, and you know how it was just like in boxing. You know, you have someone from the opposing camp observe the hand wraps, and Jake said it was okay, and the commission signed off on it. Then they sent someone else from the camp to go in there, and the commission said, hey, you've already signed it, you know, you've already okayed it. And so immediately after the fight, Jake got on Twitter and started saying, well, there's something awful funny about the hand wraps. So now the underground, and he actually posted on the underground, not Twitter. He may have been on Twitter too, but it wound up on the underground. And to the credit of the guys on the underground, no one gave it any validity. And I would think in MMA, hand wrapping, you know, playing games with that would be a lot harder than in boxing. And
yeah.
I like
well, we also
counting
had,
productive.
Johnny Hendricks earned a title shot against GSP with a win over Carlos Condit.
What a
and
fight.
That was a very good fight. Fight of the Night candidate, of course. Hendricks actually, the other thing Nick Diaz complained about after his fight was that Condit didn't get the win in this one, but Hendricks pretty much did as much as he possibly could to win that fight. And, you know, just really, I don't know if he showed enough to make me think it's going to be a great fight with GSP, but it's definitely going to be a competitive fight, I think. But Condit is a tough guy. I mean, he's just to put in that kind of tough fight. So.
And I will say, Carlos has said he knows he needs to work on his wrestling. Because I think his guard game is good. He had a very active guard, all kinds of good tricks on his feet, decent boxing, good Muay Thai, but he needs to work on his takedown defense, and he knows that, so we'll see what happens.
And quickly, hopefully I can get this through this in the next minute or so, but we have Jake Ellenberger beat Nate Marquardt by first-round knockout. Chris Camozzi beat Nick Wing by a split decision. Mike Ritchie, the ultimate fighter veteran, beats Colin Fletcher by unanimous decision. Patrick Cote, in his home area, beats Bobby Volker by unanimous decision. Darren Elkins beat Antonio Carvalho by TKO in the first round. Jordan Mean beat Dan Miller by TKO, also in the first round. We had John McDessie beat Darren Cruikshank by unanimous decision. Rick Story beat Quinn Mulhern by TKO. TJ Dillashaw beat Issei Tamura by second round knockout. And George Roop beat Ruben Doran by unanimous decision. And that's pretty much it for the show. I think we got to sign off. So until next week, folks.
All right, guys. All right.
See you later, guys. Hasta la vista.
Adios.